Oh, I wish there's a mole in the ground. Oh, I wish there's a mole in the ground. If there's a mole in the ground, then I'd root the mountains down. Oh, I wish there's a mole in the ground. Oh, I wish there's Giannata sunglasses. Oh, I wish there's Giannata sunglasses. If there's not a sunglasses, then I'd show you messages hiding before your very eyes.
I wish I was a mole in the ground. If I was a mole in the ground, I'd root that mountain down. And I wish I was a mole in the ground.
Yes, folks, this is your Old Mole Variety Hour. Bill Resnick, me hosting. Patricia Kullberg, our engineer. We, all of us at KABU, we're all moles in the ground. As to me, I'm proud and happy about that, because we're not only rooting those mountains down, but also building a new world, or at least building the embryos of it, of that new world, building it in the ashes of the old. Of course, we don't have much time, because our old world is headed for cataclysm. That on a finite planet, we can't have an economic system whose DNA demands exponential growth. That is, growth piled on growth. Put another way, as David Suzuki often said, exponential growth is the creed of the cancer cell. Or more bluntly, capitalism is destroying the ecosystems on which human life, indeed nearly all life, depends. So today, as the climate keeps heating up, today we need to build all those embryos or models of that necessary, better, democratic, sustainable new world, including its systems for energy production, agriculture, also health that we'll talk about today, transportation, city form, and others. This show, Us Old Moles, we root those mountains down, and we describe and report on the struggles to build a new world. Today we discuss several elements of that new world. First, we discuss the health system that we need, single payer, now called Medicare for All, but how to get there, that perplexes many on the left. Also today, Black Lives Matter, challenging racism in Clark County, right across the river. Later today, struggles in gender relations since World War II, the struggle to stop men behaving badly. Think Harvey Weinstein, Ray Moore, Al Franken, and lots of other studs. First, folks, today we'll play four utopian songs. All reflect the hopes and dreams of the composer-singers, of course, and the world they lived in. And there's lots and lots of those songs. Today, excerpts from Over the Rainbow, Where Troubles Melt Like Lemon Drops. Also, Louis Armstrong, It's a Wonderful World. And also, one of my favorites, Lavender Blue. It's a 17th century utopian folk song. It's become a lullaby for babies, but still with the same words. And Lavender Blue presents the vision of utopia for the English peasantry, actually serfs, and they dreamed about having a warm room and not being worked to death. Now there's a utopia for you. First song today, next a familiar song, often not seen as utopian, but it is. Here it comes.
All the world that's owned by idle drones is ours and ours alone. We have laid the wide foundation, built it skyward stone by stone. It is ours not to slave in, but to master and to own, while the union makes us strong. Solidarity forever, for the union makes us strong. have taken untold millions that they never toiled to earn. But without our brain and muscle, not a single wheel can turn. We can break their haughty power, gain our freedom when we learn that the Union makes us strong. Solidarity forever, for the Union makes us strong. In our hands is placed a power greater than their hoarded gold, greater than the might of armies magnified a thousandfold. We can bring to birth a new world from the ashes of the old, for the Union makes us strong. Solidarity forever, solidarity forever.
Hi, of course, that was Solidarity Forever, Utah Phillips, singing the original most radical verses that are often not played or understood. Even Pete Seeger's version on YouTube didn't have them. But they're getting sung much more nowadays to bring to birth a new world in the ashes of the old and to master and to own, but really it should be to care for and to care for carefully. It's a utopia that looks to the cooperative commonwealth where all meaningfully participate in the decisions that shape their lives. It substitutes radical democracy for the very steep feudal or monarchical or, in fact, capitalist hierarchies, each, of course, with their own high priests claiming that the only way is a society could possibly operate. First today on Today's Mole, Joshua Holland, welcome to KBOO.
Hey, thank you for having me. I appreciate that.
Joshua Holland's a writer, notably for The Nation magazine, also for Rolling Stone, the host of Politics and Reality Radio. Joshua Holland, you were engaged in a back and forth in The Nation magazine, a disagreement with physicians for a national health plan over the best strategy to achieve a universal, high-quality, cost-containing health system. Tell us about your disagreement with the single-payer or Medicare for all people.
Well, let me first say that I think that Medicare for All is really smart politics. Medicare is something that is popular, it's familiar, it doesn't seem like a foreign or threatening concept, and I very much agree with the goals of the people that I disagree with on the policy specifics. That is, I'm a strong advocate of universal comprehensive coverage. I think that we need greater equity, universality, obviously, cost containment, more affordability. So we start with a common set of goals. And my concern is that there are two concrete proposals on the table for Medicare for All, one by Representative Conyers in the House, another by Bernie Sanders in the Senate. And my feeling is that these are they represent the most difficult path to accomplishing these goals that we all have in common. And I'm concerned that they're becoming a kind of litmus test for progressives, that if you think that these are represent a tough path, the toughest path, then somehow you're not a real progressive or you don't favor universal health care. And the central issue that I have with these proposals is that in a relatively short period of time, they compel the 60% or so of Americans who currently get their insurance through their employer to switch into Medicare. And while that may be a good approach if you were starting from scratch, I believe that that's going to run into some very serious popular resistance. And I would kind of point to this concept known as loss aversion. Loss aversion has been studied really well by economists and psychologists, and it's basically the idea that we fear losing something that we have currently much more than we value something that might be promised to us. And I think we've seen that play out really clearly in the last couple of years' healthcare debates. In the Affordable Care Act, about 5 million people lost very substandard plans because they didn't conform with the Affordable Care Act's minimum coverage provisions. Now, most of those people got better insurance. They didn't lose their insurance coverage. They lost their specific plans. they got something better. In many, many cases, in the majority of cases, because of the subsidies, they were able to get a better insurance plan for less money out of their pocket. And despite this, and despite the fact that the ACA covered about four times that number of people who had been uninsured, those people who lost their coverage became kind of victims of Obamacare and were touted by the law's opponents again and again. And then we saw this same issue with loss aversion come up, I think, with the Republican efforts to repeal and replace. They came in and they thought, they looked at polls showing that the Affordable Care Act was not terribly popular, and they thought, okay, well, we'll repeal this. But when people were faced with the idea of losing coverage, the Affordable Care Act became much more popular, and the effort to repeal it became among the least popular pieces of legislation in history.
Yeah, you're arguing the loss aversion argument goes to a majority of people now who are not terribly happy, but they enormously, because they have such high copays, they enormously value their employer-paid insurance. For them, it's very important. It's the reason they stay at jobs. It's crucial for them. And the idea that they would lose that insurance but be promised something better, it makes them very nervous and very easily swayed to be against Medicare for all or single payer by this rabid right, which would be joined by the insurance companies, the big pharma, as well as all conservatives and all conservative forces, and a tremendous, it seems to me, expensive campaign of sowing fear.
That's an excellent summary of my argument. And one other point that I would make is that advocates of Medicare for All are 100% correct when they say that we can afford it. That is to say, we spend currently almost 18% of our economic output on health care. But what they get wrong is they assume that a dollar in new taxes has the same political impact as a dollar that's already being taken out of your paycheck and split with your boss for insurance premiums. And I think that that's just clearly untrue. This is, again, the path that is outlined in Medicare for All proposals that we have so far requires shifting almost $1.5 trillion from the private sector to the public sector in a relatively short period of time. And I think that's going to be a major, major political obstacle. Again, I'm not making the argument that we can't afford it. I'm making the argument that the path that we're looking at is really just as difficult as it can be, and it doesn't need to be. There are alternatives.
This is the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO. Bill Resnick here for the Mole, talking to Joshua Holland, who writes a lot on many different things. He's been engaged for quite a while now in a debate with the single-payer Medicare for All people who want to straight out legislate the system and change everything. We've been talking about that will create tremendous opposition, and not just, as you pointed out, Joshua, not just from many of the people, probably most of them, which are most of Americans who have now still have employer plans, lousy ones, but they value them, but also for that quarter of the Medicare population who has what is called Medicare Advantage. They're also going to lose their coverage. Losing all of those people means political disaster. And because that would be central to the next elections, it would undermine, my sense is, it undermines the entire progressive program, because it becomes the signature program it would be in the next election. And the Sanders phenomena, the uprising, the great uprising, it seems to me would just be drowned in all of those fears.
I mean, at a minimum, I believe we need to have open dialogue. You know, when I offered today at thenation.com, I have an alternative path to get to Medicare for All. It's a very bold, very progressive plan. It differs from the Sanders-Conyers approach in key ways, but it's very close to what they're proposing. And, you know, if you look at my social media feeds, you know, you would think that I'm a conservative, you know, arguing for letting the free market take care of things. It's really a problem when we make a specific policy into a litmus test without really debating the merits of that policy. And that's what I fear has been going on so far. That's what I'm trying to fight against. I'm trying to open up this discussion.
Right. Let's talk about the program that you devised. It's full of expansions of health care for all sorts of people, and it doesn't lead to that opposition. Tell us about that program and why.
Well, in simple terms, what I'm suggesting is that we expand Medicare coverage to the poor, to low-income households, to older workers, 55 through 64, and to everybody who's under 18 as a benefit. And then we offer the rest of the population, that key prime working age population, we offer them and their employers the opportunity to buy into the program, not as a benefit, but at the cost of their actual coverage. And the difference here, it's a big difference, but in another sense, it has a lot of the similarities to the Sanders-Conyers approach. Over time, if those of us who advocate single-payer coverage or universal health care are correct, this expanded Medicare program would do a better job of controlling costs. Premiums would be lower, and over time, I think that most employers and most individuals would be happy to voluntarily move into that program. So instead of compelling that group that has coverage right now to give up their coverage, we make it a choice, and we make it an attractive choice, and we allow that process to happen more or less organically. And a key point here is that right now we finance about half of our health care through the public sector, but we do it in an irrational way through fractured public programs, right? We have Medicaid administered by the states, we have Medicare, we have CHIP, and we don't have that public health care that we're spending right now in one big pool where it could realize the kind of efficiencies that single-payer systems, that is a key virtue of single-payer systems. So what I do is I roll those programs into Medicare, and then I expand it, and I let that prime working age group enter at its own time pace and picking up its own tab as opposed to doing it as a benefit through taxes.
Yeah, you mentioned that Sanders is now being critiqued by some of the more militant supporters of Medicare for All and single payer who insisted that the full program be imposed immediately. Sanders actually had the program he brought forward, whenever it was, a couple of months ago. It, in fact, calls for a phased introduction and starting with this expansion of Medicare, somewhat like yours. I wonder if the way of diffusing this instant demand for gratification that is Medicare for All immediately, if, in fact, Sanders adopted a lot of the parts of your plan, it's different. We can't go into all the details, I guess. If Sanders, in fact, and it appears that he sort of understands that problem and wants to put forward a much more comprehensive political program as the way of really building a progressive movement, is Sanders a possibility for that role?
I think that Sanders is much more pragmatic than his most enthusiastic supporters and detractors believe. his proposal still has this key, what I believe to be the key hurdle, which is that it compels that prime working age group in its entirety to give up what they have for Medicare over a four-year period, as opposed to the Conyers plan, which is within 2 years. The healthcare experts that I've spoken to still, you know, say that that's way too rapid, would create shocks to the system that are hard to anticipate. I think that Sanders is, you know, I give him a lot of credit for saying that he doesn't believe that his proposal should be a litmus test for progressives and Democrats. This is the key kind of point that I'm trying to make, is that we should have, again, a broader conversation about those things. And to the degree that he is saying the same thing, you know, that he has his proposal and it shouldn't be a litmus test, I really applaud him for that.
One final issue. One of the interests of our show is to gain a radical democratization of the institutions of daily life, showing people that they can actually participate, reducing a lot of the hierarchy and also the awe of experts and hierarchs, a sense of, the boss's brains are under the people's hats and should have a whole lot more of a role in organizing and making the decisions in their society. It seems to me the medical system just is begging for that kind of program. And in fact, even under the ACA now, under Obamacare, they've been demanding very different organizations of chronic care, which is the main cost, chronic care, diabetes, some forms of cancer where people stay alive for a very long time and at very great public expense, and their expense and the expense of their lives, that it's much better done when they use, instead of hierarchical physician-directed systems, much more democratic systems that use all sorts of home helpers. That would remain possible under your plan. It seems to me that's for certain, because it does also save a lot of money.
Well, one of the things that is common in my proposal, in Sanders' proposal, and in the existing Medicare and Medicaid plans, is the opportunity to use large pools of insured to innovate kind of different treatment paradigms, different payment schemes that bring down costs while ensuring high-quality care. The bigger the pool, though, the greater those efforts are. So, you know, I worry when people say, you know, we need to not pay attention to the experts, because this is a scientific field, and clinical research should inform a lot of our decisions. And that kind of research is encouraged by having these large pools of insurance. I think that, you know, we can see some of the efforts that are already underway under Obamacare expanded greatly if we can get what I describe as a single rate setter plan.
Right. Joshua Holland, we're out of time. Really good talking to you. Thank you so much.
Thanks so much for having me. I appreciate it.
Right. So long.
Way up high, there's a land that I heard of once in a lullaby. Somewhere upon a star, and wake up where the clouds are far behind me. troubles melt like lemon drops.
Hi, folks. That, of course, was Over the Rainbow, where troubles melt like lemon drops. And at the end of the song, of course, Judy Garland, who was from 1947, I believe, 1939, I'm sorry. She wanted to know why she couldn't fly above her troubles and like bluebirds fly. Well, we don't fly like bluebirds. It's not a real utopia, but it does sort of have this dream of leaving all the problems behind, which is not, in fact, going to happen to human beings. Next on The Old Mole, Desiree Hilliger's an interview with Cecilia Towns on Black Lives Matter in Vancouver exemplifies the problems of very big towns that are much more like small towns in their politics.
Guest today is Cecilia Towner, who is a founder and organizer of Black Lives Matter Clark County. Cecilia, thanks so much for joining me today.
Thank you for having me.
So we're talking today about the Me Too hashtag campaign, about women who have been sexually harassed, sexually assaulted, and also talking about connections specifically to violence against Black women in Clark County. You know, we've noticed nationally there's been pushback from women of color about the kind of centering of white women's experience in the Me Too campaign. And that seems particularly ironic given the fact that the Me Too hashtag or the Me Too campaign was originally begun by a Black woman named Tarana Burke in 1997. And so this was a campaign that she began and that really, as she's noted and other women have noted, particularly women of color, that this campaign, particularly when it focused more on the experiences of women of color, really did not get the kind of major support that the Me Too campaign got, particularly when Alyssa Milano, the actress, kind of launched it. And Tarana Burke's experience and her work was really erased initially, and then it was kind of raised up. There was an apology for that erasure, but still.
Yeah, it was appreciated that that went over the way that it did, that Alyssa Milano was willing to acknowledge Tarana Burke, although belatedly. And yet the media seems to continue, even after that, to have perpetuated that erasure. And even locally, the Columbian, who was actually told that Tarana Burke was the founder, still continued to say that Alyssa Milano started the Me Too movement. And Black Lives Matter chose to say something about that and educate people about that. And our community has contacted the Columbia for correction, you know, which is a relatively small thing and should be about accountability locally. And to date, that correction has not.
That story in the Columbian ran on October 19th, and on October 20th, the New York Times ran a story about Tarana Burke's campaign, kind of providing that context and talking about the erasure, and still the Columbian did not publish a correction.
No, there's been no correction, and the reporter indicates that the story is considered factually accurate.
Okay. And that story also then kind of raised broader concerns. And you found out some pretty startling data from Clark County YWCA.
I did. So while Black women are roughly 1% of Clark County, we are 37% of the YWCA's sexual assault and domestic violence participants. As opposed to white women, and white people are 87% of the population, and they are 69%. Black women are the next large percentage, and at 1% of the population, it what does that mean is for our community, and who's being served? Why are numbers so high? All of that is really, I think, important questions for people to ask.
So, do you want to just tell us what the breakdown is by ethnicity in terms of the women who are served at the Clark County YWCA, which is the only program in Clark County serving women who are fleeing domestic violence and also providing other survivor services.
Absolutely. So the highest demographics for participants of programs is white women at 69%, and the second highest is black women at 37%, then Latino women at 18.8%, and then Native American women 1.8%, Pacific Islander 1.5%, and Asian 1.3%. And what we need to point out with Pacific Islander and Native American women in particular is they have tiny, tiny percentages of the population. I don't have those stats in front, but something like
0.9. 0.9, okay. So a little bit lower than even the population of black women. Nationwide, certainly Native women, you know, represent, you know, have far higher rates of sexual and physical violence and stalking directed at them. They are the highest population nationwide aside from multiracial women.
Wow.
And to see that the stats in terms of, you know, women actually showing up and receiving those services in Clark County, that I think is startling in its own right. And I just want to clarify that according to statistics from the Justice Department, 86% of rape sexual assaults against Native women are committed by non-Native men. So mm-hmm. So kind of where are those women in Clark County who are Native going?
One of the things that locally we have to understand is in that there aren't a lot of places that are specifically safe for you as a black person or as a woman of color to go to. You have to make a choice about, are you going to report? And that with something as traumatic as sexual assault, are you going to be criminalized for it? Are you going to go through reporting and have nothing to gain from it?
So. Right, so levels of sort of comfort with law enforcement in Clark County might be a major variable, and we really are seeing a tremendous kind of resurgence of white supremacy in Clark County specifically.
We are. We have two white supremacist leaders that have moved here, and one of the white supremacist leaders is a Klansman, high ranking from Mississippi. So it's a place of concern.
But to what extent black women in Clark County may be experiencing the brunt of specifically racialized forms of sexual and physical violence?
Absolutely. And what are we doing to educate men and boys? Because women aren't raping themselves usually, right? I would like to see our community, both at the level of government and certainly with the YWCA, do more outreach towards reaching our boys and educating them. There's on the Black Lives Matter Vancouver, Washington Facebook page, we just posted a video about some people in Africa that have a program not just directed towards their young boys, but also to their young girls, and teaching a culture of it's okay to say no and how to say no and self-defense for the girls, but also that for the boys that you do the right thing. You don't just stand by and watch it happen, and certainly you don't perpetuate it. And I just think, gosh, that's amazing. And if they can do it in Africa, why are we not doing that here? It's such a simple but critical thing.
Mm-hmm. So. And it sounds like you're also concerned that there be kind of culturally appropriate services for black women and making sure that they're feeling kind of safe institutionally. I mean, I think that there's some data that demonstrates, at least anecdotally, that black women are more subject to, you know, higher rates of eviction in shelter environments. And then we have this other question, too, about is there unmet need in Clark County, which seems quite clearly the case, because there are far fewer shelter beds in Clark County than there are in Portland. And so to what extent Portland shelters are dealing with, you know, some of the overflow from women fleeing domestic violence or intimate partner violence or other forms of violence or fleeing to the street.
I do think that that brings up that we really do need racialized data reports in Clark County so that we can have a better understanding of what the need is. But we also need cultural competency, hopefully people of color able to serve people of color. But if not, then at the very least, a level of intimacy with understanding what women of color go through and how it's different over here, especially than the experience a white woman would go through. Even the phrase intersectionality was created by Kimberly Crenshaw to try to explain the black woman's experience, that the levels of oppression that she is experiencing is multi-layered. And so there might be poverty, and there might be domestic violence and sexual assault, but there's also racism, and then that requires a different level of care and compassion. We have to look at women who are having to make these hard choices, and often with children in tow, and quite often to decide to leave. Things have escalated to a place that's pretty scary, and then to be on the streets, which is also scary and dangerous for everyone concerned. And you can't really understand the dangers of it until you're in it. And to then also look around and look for support and not see it. And then if you try and find it, most people don't realize that you run out of beds, you run out of food, you run out of money, you run out of everything. There's legal aid has been chronically cut. There's not very much left in terms of resources that way. And that's going to be if you're escaping from a domestic violence marriage per se. That's really complicated if you have kids, because the kids can be used to keep you, to pull you back into that situation.
And how might other kind of patterns of housing discrimination also impede then black women's ability to move out of those limited shelter spaces that are available? And I just want to be explicit too that, as far as I know, the YWCA is the only shelter in Clark County that's specifically providing shelter to women fleeing intimate partner violence, and they only have a total of 24 beds. So there's a serious unmet need across the board.
Across the board. And you know, for black women, and honestly for all women, we don't have, it's not something we're centering. And the Me Too movement is an opportunity to start addressing that, to start saying, all right, let's find some solutions. And before we can do that, we need to have the data and a demand for accountability. So the work to be done over here in Vancouver, Clark County, is tremendous. It needs to start yesterday.
My guest today has been Cecilia Towner, who is the founder and organizer with Black Lives Matter Vancouver. Thank you, Cecilia.
Thank you.
This has been Desiree Helgers for the Old Mole Variety Hour.
What a wonderful world. Colors of the rainbow, so pretty in the sky, are also on the faces of people going by. I see friends shaking hands, saying, how do you do? They're really saying, I love you. I hear babies cry. Much more than I ever knew, and I think to myself, what a wonderful world.
That was, of course, Louis Armstrong. It's a Wonderful World, his hopes for, crudely put, going beyond racism to create the family of humans. He was the nicest man, the great exemplar of decency and patience among the oppressed. This is your morning radio zine on KABU, Portland, Oregon, State 90.7, Portland, Oregon. KABU keeps you informed, and you can get along, get involved. Next on The Mole, Jan Hocken and Joe Clement, they review the film, it's a holiday film, Miracle on 34th Street. They reflect on today's gender war. They also reflect on today's gender wars. Think Harvey Weinstein, Donald Trump, and many, many younger studs without money.
Let's start by a synopsis of Miracle on 34th Street, and we don't have to worry about spoiler alerts on this one.
No, there are a few different versions of this, but this is the oldest one from
1947. Yeah, 1947. It's kind of like Bible stories. You've seen them and heard them many times, and apparently knowing the ending does not spoil them for many. Miracle on 34th Street is a 1947 American Christmas comedy drama written and directed by George Seton and based on a story by Valentine Davies. The story takes place between Thanksgiving Day and Christmas Day in New York City and focuses on the impact of a Macy's department store Santa Claus who claims to be the real Santa. The film has become a perennial Christmas favorite. Part of what's interesting about the film, it's on my own personal favorite list. I think I know it scene by scene. I've seen it at least a dozen times. But it's made its way to the top of many feminist holiday favorite lists. So why do you think this resonates with feminists since it has many of the conventions of the 1940s? And we can talk about how some of the Hollywood censorship codes do operate in this film. What's your take on it, Joe?
Well, one of the main characters played by Maureen O'Hara, Doris, is a very successful executive in Macy's, and she's apparently a divorcee. She has a young daughter who's about 6 or 7, and she, in addition to being successful, is doesn't seem to have any problems parenting her child, and she is both respected in the workplace, and she is respected by another character in the movie who ends up courting her. There aren't really the typical sorts of stages in their courtship, which in a way reflects on how she is valued and respected as a woman in the film. But she also raises her daughter with this sense of don't be taken in by illusions. One of them being the Santa Claus story, which the film spends most of its time kind of skewering or trying to. And then there is this implicit illusion that women are falling under when they are taught that there's a Prince Charming out
right.
there who
so
will
those
save
fairy
them.
Tales.
Yeah, fairy tales in a literal and then in a cultural colloquial sense.
And it does carry some of the post-war conflict around women who had entered the workforce in historically unprecedented numbers, who occupied positions formerly held by men. And so you could see it as a historical transition piece or cultural expression of authority women still had, and not all women wanted to go back to the home, even if that option was available to them. There was a lot of it spoke to a certain post-war set of aspirations for women that were massively quashed in the 1950s, but it was very much, I think, a post-war piece of work and an expression of the gender ambivalences of that period. What about the ending, though? And then we can talk about other aspects of what makes this a feminist film. But one way of looking at the politics of film is in its denouement. How is whatever conflict emerges at the center of the story resolved at the end? And of course, at the end, spoiler alert, the girl gets her wish, the daughter, for her mother to have a house. It's not so much she wants her mother to have a husband, she wants them to have a house. And they do get this house at the end, and the her suitor, who pursues her with offering childcare and cooking, which was also part of its progressive charm. They do get the house. And so it has a kind of domestic coupling at the end, which would undercut its progressiveness.
Yeah, but it's still, I think, a much more relatable coming together of people as they do. We are a coupling species, you know, whatever kind of ideological battles we want to have over what that really looks like. And so it's relatable enough, but they don't have any of the telltale signs of marriage per se.
Or her giving up her job.
Or her giving up her job. And I mean, for a film that is as concerned with psychological fitness as this film ends up being, there's also no suggestion that she's really debilitatingly crippled emotionally or spiritually by her divorce. She is a little jaded about, you know, having been tricked by Prince Charming, who we're not really sure what happens, but it seems to have rubbed her the wrong way. And this she imparts on her daughter with this very practical minded, don't, you know, fall for illusions, don't believe things that aren't reality. And there's the suggestion that the mother has maybe limited the daughter in a way that could, if it went on this way, harm her. But what ends up happening is Santa is kind of this relief of helping the child start to get back in touch with her being a child and having an imagination, which if you watch the film, you find that she doesn't really understand how to use.
And he's a very benign old man, a grandfatherly man who, I mean, by today's standards, you wouldn't see an old man like that left alone with a little girl in a bedroom. But yeah, at that time, he was not coded as sexual. And so there is an exploratory freedom she has with this old man around her, her imagination that stays pretty much in a secular area and not taking it in a religious direction. Well, one way of reading this film against the current of the gender troubles for women that are center of controversy around sexual harassment is to admire it for positioning a woman in a powerful organizational role, which many feminists are calling for as, and in part correctly, one of the antidotes to sexual harassment. If women have more power in organizational, also have more power to mentor younger women and have the authority to discipline men, we'll have less sexual harassment. So you could read it as a call for women to have more positions in corporations and other organizations, more positions of authority.
Yeah, though they call her an executive, she is also kind of simultaneously referred to as simply an events planner, and that fits in with traditional expectations of women as performing the social labor of putting on events.
Yeah, but she has sufficient authority that she can make things happen, and she does not, she's classically beautiful, but no one comments on it. She's not pursued in ways that are diminish her in any way or challenge her authority. And one might say, well, that isn't that a fairy tale too? Because the reality is women, even at all levels, do put up with their sexuality being kind of assessed in a certain way. They can be too homely or too beautiful. It's never quite right, you know, in terms of you risk it either way. So how do we think about this film as I guess as an ideal, though, that the answer under capitalism is to have women running the show more, if not the events, the main act?
Yeah, the film is conservative in the sense that it is a story about how capitalism can regain its humanity, so to speak. The whole, you know, film is driven by this Santa Claus character becoming the Santa Claus at Macy's. And he starts to tell children, opposite of the orders he was given by Macy's, to just direct them to Macy's own toys that they have in overstock. So there's a commentary on capitalist overproduction and how this Santa figure is supposed to help align consumers with this overproduction and solve that crisis for the capitalist. He tells people to go wherever they have it, if they don't have it, or wherever there's a better deal. And this ends up coming back to Macy's in the form of customers saying, Macy's is this, you know, great public actor. They're putting people before trying to make a buck just for themselves.
Use value over exchange value. Yeah.
Right. And in this way, the film is trying to recuperate this vision of where capitalist society shortly after the war could be going. And you know, it is a vision that I think thinkers like Slavoj Žižek catch up on when they notice how companies like Starbucks and many other companies try to make the consumption of their particular product itself the fulfillment of an ethical duty because of carbon offsets or sending money to a charity.
The companies are not simply selling products. They're selling cultural values, he calls this, you know, cultural capitalism, or the commodification of values and ethics in the context of selling goods. But it also, Miracle on 34th Street also has a certain critique of that, because it's quite clear that the executives are using this to sell products. And so you could also see it as maintaining a kind of critical edge about that the illusion of an ethical consumer culture. And so it raises some questions and maybe anxieties about the post-war period and the power then at that time of the big department stores that were like the cultural the cultural square, the city square, and occupied many of those same values in people's lives and place in people's lives. But doggone it, it's a good film. I think it's still we're seeing, and always like other films, we're talking about through the contemporary lens of concerns.
This has been Joe Clement and Jan Hawken talking about the original 1947 Miracle on 34th Street. You can find it on YouTube. It's probably going to be playing on TV somewhere, or find it at the library.
This I must say, dilly dilly, and it is true. You must love me, dilly dilly, 'cause I love you. Who told you so, dilly dilly, who told you so? My own heart, dilly dilly, that told me so. Call up your men, dilly dilly, send them to work. Some to the plough, dilly dilly, some to the hoe. Some to make hay, dilly dilly, some to cut corn. While you and I, dilly dilly, keep ourselves warm.
Well, that's all, folks, for the old mole. We've been looking to the struggles towards a better democratic world, exploring health care, race troubles, men acting badly, capitalism, and consumption. There's lots of struggles from below these days on the old mole. We played four utopian songs, all reflect the hopes and dreams of their composer-singers, the world they live in. Judy Garland's Over the Rainbow, where troubles melt like lemon drops. The dreams that you dream, dare to dream, really do come true. And you just, then there's Louis Armstrong, It's a Wonderful World. And you just heard Lavender Blue, a 17th century utopian folk song. It's become a lullaby for babies, but still with the same words. Utopia for the English peasantry serfs, actually serfs. They dreamed about having a warm room and not being worked to death. And, of course, being a king and queen. First song today, the utopian song, was a familiar song not often seen as utopian, Solidarity Forever. It's a utopia that looks to the cooperative commonwealth, where everybody meaningfully participates in the decisions that shape their lives. To master and to own this universe, but that's no longer politically correct, but it's to care for and to be mindful of. Thanks to Joshua Holland on Medicare for All, How to Win It. Thanks to Win Universal Medical Care. Thanks to Desiree Helligers and Cecilia Towns for talking about racism in Clark County. To Jan and Joe and the gender wars and Miracle in 34th Street. Thanks also to all of you out there who support this station. Since we live stream and archive everything, all 24 hours a day of programming, we get support from all over the planet. Finally, you can hear this show or any part of it again or any of our previous shows or recommend us to your friends. Tell them to go to the web on KABU and go to the top right, the search box, and type Old Mole or Old Mole Variety Hour. Today's show should be up very soon. I'm Bill Resnick, your host today, signing off for The Mole. Thanks to Patricia Kullberg, our engineer. See you next Monday. One final thing, if you haven't done it yet, please call this station during the pledge membership drive. Reach out to some and help some wonderful radio station. So long.
KBOO Portland.